Aloha and welcome to Our Homes, Ending the Housing Crisis. My name is Stanley Chang, and I'm a state senator in Honolulu, Hawaii. We're here to understand housing more deeply and seek new, innovative solutions from all over the world to the severe housing crisis here. But many of the lessons may also apply to your community, wherever you may be. And now, on with the show. Okay, good morning, and welcome to Our Homes Ending the Housing Crisis. Our guest today is Kim Van Sparentak. She's been a member of the European Parliament, or an MEP, since 2019, and is a member of a Green Party from the Netherlands. She was the rapporteur, or author, of the European Parliament's report on access to decent and affordable housing for all. Kim, welcome to Our Homes, Ending the Housing Crisis.
Thank you very much. Good morning, evening. Yes.
Yes, thank you for joining us all the way from the Netherlands. We have many time zones between us.
Indeed. We're exactly 12 hours apart, I think.
Great. Well, let's begin. How did you first become interested in housing issues?
Well, actually, as I'm a Green and I've been a part of the climate movement for many years, for me, housing is really clearly one of the prime examples of where we can create a just transition, you know, a fair transition to a more equal and fair society through, you know, climate mitigation. And actually, that's how it really sparked my interest at some point when I found out about a neighborhood where they had interviewed the inhabitants, and they were talking about, you know, sustainability and the relationship between housing, health, sustainability, and the cost of their energy bills. And for me, it was very clearly a way to look at, you know, how we can actually use the climate transition to create a more social and sustainable world in the housing sector.
So obviously the climate is a, you know, global concern. It's been a top priority for world leaders for years now. President Obama convened several conferences where climate change was the principal issue. Where is housing on the list of priorities in the European agenda?
Well, actually, we have a Green Deal now, and in the Green Deal, you know, we cover every aspect. But one of the key initiatives within the Green Deal, which is really related to, you know, what the people will experience, because, of course, there's a lot of things that will happen in industry, for example. This is it is the renovation wave, and this is about how we will mitigate carbon emissions from buildings, and there's a specific part of that is related to housing, specifically the Affordable Housing Initiative.
Great. And so, speaking of the carbon emissions, how significant a factor do you think that housing is, and all the factors that surround housing, such as transportation and heating and so on, in terms of European carbon emissions?
Well, it's actually quite a large part because we have a lot of old buildings, of course, in Europe. And we now have, since quite some years, we have the European housing housing labeling system. And that's how we, you know, classify whether a house is actually sustainable or not. And you know, now we have a very good overview of, you know, where the houses are with the worst quality. So it is quite a significant bit, and that's also why the renovation wave was initiated. And next to that, of course, you know, renovating loads of houses and buildings is also very good for the economy, because we're going to create a lot of jobs, and we're going to invest a lot in the housing sector.
So speaking of those older buildings, you know, when we picture some of the historic neighborhoods in Europe that we all are familiar with, for example, Amsterdam with its row houses, with its canals, they tend to be car-free because, of course, they were built before the advent of the automobile. Do you think that those buildings are more sustainable, or do you think the modern buildings in a modern suburb that are car-dependent, that are maybe lower rise, lower density, are more sustainable?
Well, I guess, you know, the specific ones in Amsterdam have a very strict building code because they're UNESCO and they're not allowed to have double glazing and, unless it's in a very pretty way. But I think in general, you know, having dense cities, you know, where you have walkable and cyclable options to get to everywhere you need. If you look from an urban planning perspective, of course, that's more sustainable on the long run. We don't have, you know, the type of suburbs so much as in the United States. You know, transforming our cities into more walkable, cyclable cities, having better connection to public transport is perhaps a bit easier. So if you look at the whole picture, perhaps, you know, it is more sustainable also, you know, just because of the fact that if you live in an apartment and the houses around you are also occupied, then you use less heating because you will also get heating from your neighbors.
So let's talk a little bit about your report, the Access to Decent and Affordable Housing Report. How are you selected to write that report?
Well, in the European Parliament, we have different committees, and I'm a member of the Social Affairs and Employment Committee. And one of the first decisions that we as that committee made was to actually write a report, an own initiative report, with recommendations for the European Commission and the member states to do something about the housing crisis. And then there's this whole internal procedure with negotiations. And in the end, the decision was made that it would be a Green member of the European Parliament that would write it. And out of the Greens, I was selected to write it.
Cool. Well, now that it's been out, what benefits, what effects do you hope that the report will have?
So interestingly, perhaps, officially the European Union doesn't have real competence on housing policy. So the European Commission can't decide what kind of housing policies member states or cities have to impose. But there's a lot of European policies that have effect on the housing market. The European Union is really based on market values. So it is very easy for capital to flow from one country to another in and out of the housing market. But it's much harder to actually protect the fundamental right of housing. And that's what we wanted to change. So that's where we started. That was the starting point of the report. We said, okay, we have to treat housing as a fundamental right. It's part of the European Charter. It's a part of the European Pillar of Social Rights. Housing should be treated as a fundamental right. Let's look at all these policies that have an effect on the housing market, all these European policies, and give recommendations in order to make sure that, you know, it's treated as a fundamental right. So since the adoption of the report, which was at the beginning of this year, we've had several conversations already with the Commission. One of the things that we're looking at is homelessness. How do we ensure that everyone actually has a roof over their head and not just sleep rough or lives in a shelter? So that's where we're getting quite far now. And actually in a few weeks, a European collaboration platform on ending homelessness will be launched in Portugal under the Portuguese presidency. So that's a pretty cool step, which was co-initiated through our report. And another important thing is that we are trying to look at the way that the European Commission is recommending macroeconomic systems in the European Union. Because now, you know, housing and the housing market is really looked at from the standpoint of macroeconomic systems. And we want, we have recommended the Commission to look more at, you know, also at the social effects, the housing crisis. And it's actually, it seems that this is going to be part of the new way of dealing with housing from the European Commission.
Could you talk a little bit more about what those social effects might look like and how you're hoping to adjust them?
Well, what we've actually seen is that since this report has been adopted, a lot of people feel strengthened. While I was writing the report and doing research for the report, we spoke with many activists, we spoke with many NGOs on, you know, what do you need from us? What do you need from the Parliament to recommend to the Commission? Ever since the report has been adopted, there has been many initiatives in several cities. where they called for the same things or tried to change things in line with the report. And we've seen a lot of more action amongst NGOs and also more willingness amongst the people to start fighting for more affordable housing. Because, you know, in the end, when we're talking about a housing crisis, it's because, you know, there's so many people all over Europe that are not able to afford, you know, a decent house. And you know, the problem is growing. So something has to change.
One of the main points that you addressed in your report is the influx of major institutional investors into the housing market in Europe. And that's actually a topic that is very popular here in Hawaii too, the idea that wealthy overseas investors are coming in, snapping up the housing stock, crowding out local families, and of course are looking for a very rapid return on their investment, and so are hoping to resell their homes at a much higher price in the future. How much of an effect do you think this has on the European housing market? Is it concentrated in specific locations? Is it primarily American-based public private equity firms?
Well, that's definitely one of the firms is, of course, Blackstone. We see really entering the market. Of course, they've also announced already that they, I think, have 10 billion euros ready for when the crisis really hits and they can buy some more houses when people are losing them. But we also have some big German investment funds and quite some pension funds that are part of this system of big corporations that are just buying up housing. And we see that it's actually a problem everywhere. It started in the big cities, in the touristic areas, in the popular metropolitan areas, but actually it's really expanding right now. And what we see very often is that mainly older neighborhoods that have usually been, you know, really for the working class, that are now just being bought up completely and transformed into, you know, all the family houses, for example, are being transformed into small, tiny apartments just for profit. And this is really bad for the social cohesion in these neighborhoods. And interestingly enough, the end of last week, actually in the Netherlands, some major cities have announced that they are going to change their zoning plans in such a way that these big financial organizations, these corporations, won't be able to buy in certain neighborhoods anymore, just to make sure that, you know, they don't become ghost neighborhoods with empty apartments or actually too full just with students and labor migrants, etc.
So that's actually an interesting phenomenon. And whether it's large investment firms like Blackstone or pension funds, or whether they're individual wealthy investors from overseas, it's true that the housing market has become attractive and delivered high rates of return on investment, in large part because construction has slowed down. And so there's very little new supply coming onto the market. If we were to see a jurisdiction with a lot of outside investment, if that jurisdiction really wanted to make it unattractive for outside investors, couldn't it simply build a lot more housing and then dilute the rate of return on investment? Because with a large amount of new supply injected into the market, housing prices just wouldn't increase as rapidly?
Well, I mean, in general, we see that there has been a lack of investment. And in Europe, we're talking about an investment gap of about 57 billion euros a year already for the past 10 years. But what we see happening is that the houses that are being built right now are very often very expensive apartments just for the investment. And the whole problem is actually that affordable housing is not available. Affordable housing is being bought up. And, you know, people, starters on the housing market, don't stand a chance of buying these cheaper houses, because these investment funds always will be able to bid over more. So we need to build more housing. That's clear. We also need to have a stronger look, perhaps, at, you know, the needs. There's not that many big families anymore. There's more single parent families, for example. So perhaps the needs are changing, but the lack of affordable housing is what is the biggest problem right now in almost everywhere in Europe.
So you mentioned that European investment in affordable housing has been declining for decades now. And so, back in the 1980s, it seems that there was a trend where a lot of countries like the United Kingdom, like Germany, that had large public housing portfolios started to privatize them by selling them off. Why do you think that these jurisdictions have reduced their investment in social housing over the years? And do you think that that has contributed to the attractiveness of residential real estate as an investment sector?
Well, I mean, especially when you look at, you know, Eastern Europe after the 80s, you know, after the fall of the Iron Curtain and the Berlin Wall, these countries needed to get more money. And especially Berlin is a great example of how they just decided to not only sell off all their housing stock, but also sell off their land. Because they just needed the money to rebuild a lot of the infrastructure that had been run down in all those years. So you really see that a lot of housing has been privatized. But interestingly, in Berlin as well, actually, there's a very high rate of people renting. There's not that much home ownership. But what you see happening is that, you know, they haven't only sold off their buildings, but their land. So it's really hard, for example, and other major cities in Eastern Europe, to ensure to decide what is actually happening on their land, because they don't own it anymore. So that is one of the issues we're seeing. And next to that, you know, we see indeed that in the areas where, you know, it has been completely privatized, and there's that it's just much harder to control the rents. More social housing doesn't only mean that there's more affordable housing, that there's more money going from the state into, you know, to citizens, but it'll, like, people, like, if the state or if the government or the city council invests in housing, only investing in a house, in a block where you can live in, but they're actually investing, you know, in a neighborhood, in social cohesion. And you see that private investors usually care more practically about the profit. So that is, I think, one of the things that we're also really seeing in this shift from social housing to private housing, is that also the social cohesion in the neighborhood is not taken into account as much anymore as it used to.
So maybe some jurisdictions like Germany really moved away from social housing and really tried to emphasize the private sector in recent years, but there are some bright spots. Famously, the city of Vienna has attractive, affordable housing for all, has embarked on that program since the 1920s, so it's been almost 100 years now. What do you think is the reason for jurisdictions like Vienna's success, when other jurisdictions have really fallen behind in recent years?
Well, I think for Vienna, you know, there's many, many things to say about it, but Vienna has realized that it works, that they can have a mixed city with people from all backgrounds, all living together, very mixed neighborhoods as well. And they're just very proud of it. There's a lot of pride in the Viennese system. Because of the way they do it, it's often also a private-public collaboration. So the city of Vienna says, okay, we need this type of housing. These are boxes that we need to tick. And then a private building company, for example, can come in and say, okay, we take all these boxes. And then it's sort of a competition. But in the end, Vienna still decides, you know, if housing has to be affordable, what type of housing is necessary. And it's just proven to be very effective. So I think, you know, this purely only public housing, you know, what it used to be back in the days, they have shifted that a bit. But the core of, you know, deciding, you know, that we need affordable housing, that we can't have Vienna only for the wealthy and the rich, I think, you know, it's working out. And they're indeed an example for many other cities.
So since you already mentioned homelessness, and since we're already getting questions about homelessness, it is an important part of your report. You call for an end to homelessness in Europe by the year 2030, which is only 9 years away now. You've stated in the report, we can solve the housing crisis if we want to, but you've also called ending homelessness a social moonshot. So do you think it is realistic? And if so, what will it take to end the housing shortage and homelessness by the year 2030?
So it is realistic and possible if there is political will. And that is, of course, always the question. I've spoken with many people and NGOs who are working in the homelessness area and have worked with a lot of people and know the situation on the ground. In Europe, the amount of homelessness has doubled in the past 10 years. And, when we actually look at, if that's differentiated in different countries, we see that there's actually some countries where the amount of people that are homeless has gone down. So we really looked into that. And Finland is the big examples. In Finland, they have decided that they want to end homelessness because they want to treat housing as a fundamental right, as a human right. So the government has said, okay, we are going to end homelessness. We're going to use the housing first method, which means that people who are homeless get a house. And after that, then there are programs, if necessary, to get back on their feet, if that's necessary. So the basis is, okay, you're homeless. The problem is you don't have a home. Okay, we'll give you a home. And then, we go further from that. And it's proven very successful. And the current government said, okay, so this term, we're not going to make it. But by next term, we don't end on homeless anymore in Finland, which would mean that that they will end homelessness by 2027, 2028. Just seeing this example and seeing other examples more on a local level, where there has been this conscious decision of, okay, we don't want homeless people anymore. We don't want anyone to have to sleep rough anymore in our cities. They do it. So ending homelessness by 2030 is a social moonshot. We can do it if we want to. We just have to have the willingness, the engagement, and then we can actually end homelessness by 2030. But the will has to be there.
So do you think the will is there?
It really depends per country. I have addressed the European Commission with several letters, and there's been ministers co-signing letters to have this as an actual goal in the European Union to end homelessness. And there are still some countries who don't want to comply, and that's what we need in Europe. We always need almost all the countries to agree with a certain issue. There are some countries that are actually going completely the other way. They're trying to criminalize homelessness. We have different forces, different political forces in Europe. But we do see that, there is a momentum. The COVID crisis, I think, has even like it already, this, okay, homelessness has doubled in the past 10 years was already ringing, in a lot of policymakers' heads. And then a COVID crisis came, and suddenly, almost everyone who was homeless was suddenly sheltered. They were put in temporary places in hotels or wherever. And suddenly there were solutions for all the people that were homeless. So that has also, really changed something in the mindset, like, okay, so there's actually, if we want to, we can actually, shelter people. And there's actually really interesting examples already happening also in several cities. For example, the city of Lyon in France, they had this temporary hotel where people who were homeless could stay during the COVID crisis. And they said, okay, well, we can go with a hotel less. So they bought up the hotel, they transformed the hotel rooms into proper apartments to make sure that, these temporary measures to help homeless people actually become permanent. And, I think this has really changed the mindset, this whole idea of, COVID and your house being your primary shelter for something like a disease. it has helped, you know, in pushing forward for ensuring homeless people get higher on the agenda.
Yeah, I think certainly the increasing prices of residential real estate have also helped to, shine a spotlight on housing issues in the United States, even during the pandemic. So your report passed the European Parliament with 352 votes in favor, 179 against, and 152 abstentions. And so, you know, we're not familiar with the European parliamentary system, but can you talk about why some of those folks might have objected to this report and what those sources of concern were to the report?
Well, we have one group in the parliament with the more far-right groups who vote quite against everything that is sort of positive or social, at least that's how I see it. So that's already a group that I wasn't counting on for their votes. And then there were some other groups, primarily on the right of the parliament, that found that it was going too far. And it was mainly, in my opinion, old narrative that, the market will solve it, don't worry. Whereas if you look at the facts, this is what we decided around the 80s when we started selling off all our social housing. We said, okay, the market will fix it. And I think this has been a pretty bad real life experiment that has totally proven that the market will not fix it. The market will make houses more expensive because people want to make a profit. So that was the main reason. And also because we were calling for higher climate ambitions in renovating the housing in Europe, too many climate ambitions was also not for them.
Okay, so speaking of the private sector, so we have success stories where housing is a public sector led initiative, such as the city of Vienna, which produces enough public housing to house 60% of its population. And if we're talking about the private sector, there are examples in the world where housing is almost entirely private sector produced and also very affordable and reasonably priced to the people. And so one example would be the city of Houston in Texas, where there's very little public sector housing production. Almost all of it is private sector housing. And this is in large part because it is almost unrestricted to build housing in Houston without zoning. The city of Houston has no zoning. So in other words, anyone can build anything, anywhere, anytime. You could tear down your house and build a gas station or an office building or an oil refinery if you wanted to. Why do you think that the European movement has not gone into that direction, a more extreme laissez-faire system where the private sector would be able to, build anything, anywhere, anytime?
Well, first of all, I think that's because Europe tends to pride itself a lot on their social model. So that is just not really part of, the European narrative. But next to that, I think also simply because we have less space than in the United States, it's simple as that. We don't have the space to continue building forever in cities. And I think in Europe, when we're talking about urban planning, for us, we very often prioritize really, social cohesion, also being able to have public transport, cyclability, walkability. That's much more part of the way that we build our cities, we have our urban planning systems set up. So I think, it's just almost unimaginable to have, a city that just keeps on expanding and where everyone can do whatever they want. Of course, we have some of these examples. It's usually very small, like, just one road that just continues going forever, and there's just houses adding up. But really on a city level, you see that, there's more, usually more, more density, and we have more apartment buildings as well.
Okay, so going back to, you know, that and also something you talked about earlier. So in the United States, land use is primarily a responsibility of local and county level governments. So the city of Houston can determine its own land use, which might be different from the city of Dallas, you know, also in the state of Texas. And obviously you are on the European level, which is even higher than the national level. So you have the local level, you might have the state or provincial level, the national level, and then you're at the Europe-wide level. What is the relationship between all these different levels of government when it comes to housing issues?
So basically, local cities usually do the zoning and the planning. And Europe is more about, you know, the movement of capital, but also about state aid. Whether you a city or a member state is allowed to give state aid, and these rules are also very often targeted at housing. So basically, I guess if you would have to explain it very simply, you know, the cities decide where the houses are built, and then the national level decides how much funding there is for those houses, and then the European level decides whether the member states can actually give that amount of funding for the houses. I guess if we're talking about the financial aspects, that's where we are in Europe. And next to that, we can set out the guidelines for the building directive. So that is the building materials. What do they have to comply to? Health and safety of the workers in the building sector. We do a lot of research and work on homelessness on a European level. But I can't tell Amsterdam where to build their houses. No.
That's definitely a vigorous debate right now, in especially the state of California, where, you know, the question is, who should have more responsibility over land use, the local level governments or the state level governments? And so that's a very interesting response. So our audience is welcome to submit questions through the Q&A feature on this Zoom chat. And of course, we've already discussed some of the concerns like homelessness that have come out in the chat. Well, we do have more questions. And so speaking of all those different levels of government, let's say that you were, you did have a magic wand, Kim, you could do whatever you wanted to the European housing system by fiat. What are the, you know, one or two changes that you would make that you think would have the greatest impact on ending the housing shortage there?
Well, I think ending the financialization of the housing market would be one of my first things I would do. And that's, on the one hand, then, you know, ensuring that all these houses aren't being built, bought up by these big financial investors, and, you know, are being brought back preferably to a social or a public system. I mean, it can be the city council, it can be a housing corporation that can ensure that the housing stays affordable and accessible for everyone. And next to that, you know, as part of that ending of the financialization of the housing market, I would try to end the expansion of short-term holiday rentals. If you look at certain cities in Europe, for example, Venice, they have, I think, twice the amount of beds for tourists as for the people actually living in Venice. And most of that, most of those beds are in houses. Permits even to be a holiday house. This touristification of cities the fact that it's becoming harder and harder to actually, you know, have an affordable house in any city, that is the first thing I would end.
It's interesting that you mentioned tourism, because of course Hawaii is another major tourism destination, and I think a lot of the same concerns exist. Do you think that this large-scale tourism in places like Prague or Amsterdam or Venice or Paris, is it a net positive or is it a net negative? And if it's a net negative, for those of us in, say, the United States who dream of exploring the historic city centers, of seeing the great art that we learned about in school, in enjoying the cuisine and the culture of these beautiful and historic countries, should we stay away instead of visiting them?
I don't think you have to stay away. I think it's always very nice to meet people from elsewhere when you're in a capital in Europe. That's also one of the fun things. Usually when you're here, you just meet people from all over the world. The main problem that we see is that tourism is completely concentrated. So for example, when you're talking about Amsterdam and those beautiful canal houses, you know, it's an area of Amsterdam, it's a small area of Amsterdam, and that's where all the tourists are. For people who live in that area, it's you know, almost impossible to go out without stumbling over another tourist. So I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with tourism. I think it's just that, you know, this mass tourism all situated in one place, without, you know, the city council being able to manage in any way where the tourists are staying, that is one of the main problems. And of course, you know, I also think that, you know, something that we're discussing, perhaps not from an American perspective, from a European perspective, you don't have to go on a city trip to another town every weekend. You know, that's, you know, also not good for the environment to fly all over Europe all the time. You know, we've all learned during COVID that staycations can also be fun. So, you know, I think tourism is something positive. It can bring something very positive to communities, but mass tourism, I don't think that there is ever a net positive there.
Okay, so one of our audience members is asking, are there policies and strategies that support both climate resilience and housing justice that you are most inspired by?
Yes, actually. So there's been a neighborhood, it's my favorite neighborhood. now I'm gonna totally sound like a housing and city nerd, which I actually also am, but still. So there's a neighborhood in Sweden, in Malmö. And in Malmö, they had a very big exhibition on sustainability, and they decided to build a very fabulous, fancy, sustainable neighborhood, state of the art, all the most modern inventions were there. But there were also quite some other neighborhoods in the city that were struggling. There was a lot of violence, a lot of unemployment. The mayor said, okay, but we also have, like, if we create this beautiful neighborhood for the upper class, we should also do something for the people that are struggling in our city. So people from the city council went to these neighborhoods, and specifically one of them is called Augustenburg, and he started talking with the citizens, and he asked them, okay, what do you want? Like, what do you want in your neighborhood? How do you think we can improve the situation in your neighborhood? And the people said, well, we have very high energy bills. It gets very cold in Malmö. We have very low quality houses, so, you know, we need a lot of heating. So we have very high and unstable energy bills, so we need help with that. You know, the streets were very run down. There was no social cohesion. People didn't like going outside at night. So it would be nice if we have, you know, a bit more open spaces. We don't feel unsafe when we walk at home at night. And actually, you know, we've seen this cool neighborhood that you've been building. You know, we want that. We want solar panels. We want all these cool technologies as well. So the city actually said, okay, that's what we're gonna do. And they have renovated the neighborhood with the absolute promise that no one was gonna get higher rent or was going to be kicked out. So the same residents still live there. But their housing has been completely isolated and upgraded. So their energy bills have gone down a lot. They had a lot of trash always on the streets. So they have now a recycling center where people from the neighborhood actually work. So that also has solved part of the unemployment and the trash on the street. And in general, the pride of that neighborhood has increased. Environmental pollution from that neighborhood has completely gone down, and, you know, the social quality and the quality of life of the people living there has gone up. So I think, you know, this is another example of, you know, if you just want to support people and, you know, want to use the climate transition also to improve people's quality of life, you can do it. It's so often about political choices. But this neighborhood for me is one of my main inspirations when I think about, you know, what you can actually do as a policymaker talking about housing and climate.
And what was it that made that neighborhood so successful? Was it that the political will was there, that the mayor was willing to put funding behind these types of initiatives?
Yes, and in combination actually with actually asking the people who lived there what they wanted. It was not a top-down decision. It was a collaboration. They even, actually my favorite thing in that neighborhood is the fact that they also spoke with the kids from the local school, and the kids all said, well, we have very small houses, but we love to have pets. So now they have a rabbit hotel in that neighborhood where the kids learn how to take care of the rabbits. They learn how to grow carrots, and also they learn about democracy, because every week they have to elect someone to be in charge of the carrots provision to the rabbits. I mean, you know, like, so many beautiful things are possible. We have to be more creative sometimes when we're thinking about, you know, the climate transition. It's not just closing down coal power plants, it's also making, you know, nicer neighborhoods and reducing carbon emissions at the same time.
Well, speaking of those kids and their rabbit hotel, what do you think it will take to get young people interested in the issues of housing?
Well, actually, I don't know what's the situation in Hawaii, but actually it's mainly young people that are very engaged right now in Europe to fight for more affordable housing, because you see that they are stuck. So you see actually kids who are going to study or want to get out of their parents' house, they already can't find a room. You know, they already can't find a space, so they actually stay longer at their parents' place. Well, then they finally have this student house, and then they would like to live together because they found a partner, for example. Well, they stay forever in that student house before they can actually find a place where they can live with their partner. And then they have this tiny place, and then actually perhaps they would like to have kids, but there's absolutely no space in the tiny space that they have. So you see that life decisions, especially by young people, are being postponed more and more because of the housing crisis. So it's actually young people that are very much engaged. And that's actually, it's actually quite interesting, because it's young people at, you know, the beginning of their housing career. I never really like that term, but I never know how to say it different. The young people that, you know, can't really start their housing career. And then you have the people at the end of their housing career. So, you know, elderly people who would actually like to move out of their big family home because it's too big for them now. They would like to go to more of an adjusted apartment, for example, that are not able to then, you know, buy one of those apartments because they're quite scarce. And also because it's almost as expensive as having a massive family home. You see that, you know, the whole housing market is quite stuck, and it's young people that are really, really vocal about it. And also, I think, you know, social media, they also just have a lot of fun with it. I don't know, there's quite some people in Amsterdam, for example, young people that if they see, I don't know, like a little birdhouse or something, that they make fake advertisements like, oh, beautiful room for only 800 euros, just to make fun of the situation. So young people are very engaged here.
Well, that's great that they're so engaged there. And in fact, in the US, we're seeing a similar phenomenon called YIMBY, the YIMBY movement, in which a lot of the young people who have relocated to high cost areas in California are fighting to build more housing. But it has been very controversial in the United States. And on the other side of the so-called YIMBY or Yes in My Backyard movement are the movements that arise anytime a new housing development is proposed. So in my experience, having served in both the city council and the state legislature, it doesn't really matter what the nature of the proposed development is. If it's affordable housing in, you know, a 74 unit building of affordable housing in an area that is in desperate need of affordable housing, if it's a proposal to build multi-million dollar condos on the most prestigious residential avenue in the entire state, all of them will be met by strong and fierce and unrelenting opposition from their neighbors of whatever age, young and old. And that's, I think, one of the main obstacles to new housing supply in America, because even if, say, the federal government and President Biden with his, you know, jobs plans and American Rescue plans were to come in with a huge amount of funding for affordable housing here in Hawaii, the reality is that everywhere it would be proposed in Hawaii, there would be strong resistance from those local communities. How is that dealt with in Europe? Has Europe found out a way to overcome objections from neighbors who might not want new development in their communities?
Good question. I think it's really, really depends per country. So I will now speak more from a Dutch perspective. In the Netherlands, if there is a big plan in your neighborhoods, you can always give an objection to the city council, and then there's some consultations. But in the end, usually the zoning wins. So if the zoning plan says, you know, there's going to be a high-rise apartment here, and it's allowed to have a high-rise apartment here, then usually you're being pushed aside, and they just say, well, you could have known that you live next to a place where it was allowed to build a high-rise building. So that's what it is. But then I'm speaking from a Dutch perspective. In the Netherlands, literally every square meter is zoned. We're quite unique. It's quite fun if you ever look at a map of the Netherlands and our zoning plans, is literally every square meter is planned. But yeah, I think that is the main way it's dealt with it. And I'm not sure if that's the way I would favor, to be honest. What you see in many other places, though, which I think is really a new way forward that we can really learn from more. And it's actually not happening that much in the Netherlands yet, but you see it very, see it really popping up, for example, in Germany, is cooperations, cooperative housing. So it's actually a group of residents that get together and say, okay, we need housing, we would like to build a block together. And usually it's really a group of motivated people, often also, you know, a very mixed group of people, where they also have an idea of like a shared area where, you know, the elderly people can be helped by students, for example, that live in the same building. And usually you see when you have this cooperative spirit in a community that's being building a new building block, they also engage the rest of the neighborhood. So I think, you know, really participation from the neighborhood is one of the key elements to ensure that, you know, you don't have these protests, and to ensure that people are not unhappy with new housing that's being built.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably the fundamental problem in the United States, in the jurisdictions with housing shortages like Hawaii. You know, if developers come and say, well, we're happy to build more housing, but the zoning only allows us to build single family homes or agricultural dwellings instead of a tower, you know, whether it's that or whether the zoning already allows the tower, people are just not... They just don't want more development. No more traffic, no more tall buildings, no more congestion, noise, crime, and so on. And, you know, in a democratic system, we have to give the people what they want. So it's a difficult challenge, and we still need to work hard on it. So one of the other differences between the United States and Europe is, of course, something we've already mentioned, which is that in American cities, the housing stock tends to be concentrated in single family home residential suburbs that are highly car dependent, where, you know, you really do need a car to get to school, to get to the office, to get to the grocery store, the post office. There's nothing you can do within walking distance. And that is quite different from Europe, where a lot of the cities and communities are historic. They date to the pre-car era. In many neighborhoods, the medieval cities are actually, the lanes and the streets are so narrow that a car is not even able to move through them. In some, you know, the neighborhoods are connected by stairs, so there's no way for a car to traverse them. What would you say to folks in Hawaii or in the United States who would say, you know what, a car is essential in a modern family. We need to have not just a car, but two cars, three cars, four cars per family, and who cannot even imagine a life without cars in a more dense neighborhood.
Yeah, well, I can start with saying I don't have a car. I've never had a car and I'm completely fine. I think that's a start. I think many people my age who live in bigger cities with good public transport have the same. You don't really need a car in European cities because we have very good public transport often. We have cycleways and, a lot of things are in walking distance. But it's not only in the old city centers. You know, the neighborhood I grew up in was built in the end of the 80s. I could walk to school, I could walk to the supermarket, I could walk everywhere. And a car wasn't necessary. There's a lot of discussion still also in Europe, you know, like how much space do you need per house for in terms of parking space per city? Should we make that less? Should we make that more? But what we see in general is that, it's much more common to have, public transport and really have like communities in one area where which are just connected with safe walkways, and that's just our modus operandi, I guess. If I look at a map of an American city, for me it's really incomprehensible to see how wide it is and how many single homes there are. Because we just don't have that in the European Union. I think what is very interesting, though, is to see, what does it actually cost in terms of energy? Because, if you need a car to go everywhere, that's going to cost you a lot of gas. But also, having this single family home, you also need more heating or cooling down. So dense cities are a way also to preserve more nature, and it's actually quite interesting to think because probably when you look at it from an American perspective, you think, okay, I have nature around my house, whereas in Europe we have decided to put all the houses more closely together and have nature around it. I think it is always very fascinating that we have such different views on what is regular and what is the way to go in terms of urban planning.
So as we're winding down in time here, maybe we'll take one question. What is one thing that you think that the United States could learn from the European housing systems, and what is one thing that you think the Europeans can learn from the American housing systems?
Ooh, good question. Well, I'm more familiar with the European one. And as I said, I think, urban planning in terms of, social cohesion and, a neighborhood having all the amenities, making sure you have a supermarket in your neighborhood that you can just walk to the school, etc. I think, looking beyond having access to a house, but you just be broader than that, making sure you have everything in a proper distance. I think that is something that the United States can still learn from Europe. And perhaps, we could learn a bit more about, that it's nice to have a garden because there's so many people in Europe that don't have one. But I don't know. I don't really know other examples. That's what I think about when I think of American housing, is that you have a lot of gardens, and that would be nice to have more space for gardens sometimes.
Great. Okay. Well, we've had a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. You've shared quite a bit about the situation in Europe, which is a big place and which nevertheless shares some of the challenges that we have here in Hawaii and generally in the United States. and your work in climate change, in the environment, and in the housing sector is very inspiring to us. I hope that one day soon you will get the chance to visit us so you can see the housing situation in Hawaii firsthand. And
I wouldn't mind that at all.
Great. And I hope that we too will get the chance to visit your beautiful home country of the Netherlands and Europe generally, because there are a lot of really inspiring things that are happening there. So Kim van Sperentek from the European Parliament, thank you so much for joining us on Our Homes Ending the Housing Crisis.
Thank you.
All right. Well, have a great day, everyone. And thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Our Homes, Ending the Housing Crisis. And thank you for being part of the solution.